For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Prosecutors present dramatic evidence and wrap up their case against James Alex Fields, Jr. JMU students innovate a new approach to better care for Harrisonburg's homeless, and a Massanutten snow farmer prepares for climate change. This is the WMRA Daily for Wednesday, December 5th.
Support for the WMRA Daily comes from the shops at Stonefield at Route 29 and Hydraulic Road in Charlottesville, featuring a collection of shopping, dining, and entertainment experiences with parking available. Learn more at shopsatstonefield.com.
Prosecutors presented dramatic evidence Tuesday in the trial of James A. Fields, Jr., accused of driving his car into a crowd of counter-protesters after a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hausman was in court as prosecutors finished their case.
For the first time, jurors heard the defendant explaining his deadly actions on August 12, 2017, in a video recorded by the policeman who stopped him after the crash. "I'm sorry," he blurted repeatedly. "I didn't want to hurt people, but I thought they were attacking me." Asked if he needed medical attention, Fields said it was more important that paramedics attend to the people hurt in the crash. "Are they okay?" he asked the officer. He was taken in for questioning and informed that several people were seriously injured and one had died. At that point, he began to hyperventilate, and members of the jury stared at the defendant, who seemed nervous, flipping a pencil in his hand. After more than 2 minutes, he regained his composure on the video and continued, "I saw two cars down the street trying to leave. I was trying to leave as well to go home," Fields said, sniffling. As he drove toward the crowd, he recalled, "The counter-protesters were coming at me, surrounding the cars in front of me. I didn't know what to do." Next, prosecutors played excerpts from two jailhouse calls Fields made to his mother. In one, he said he was not doing anything wrong, and then I get mugged by a violent group of terrorists. He claimed the counter-protesters were waving the ISIS flag and expressed no sympathy for Heather Heyer or her mother, an outspoken critic of white supremacists. Fields branded her a communist and the enemy. In Charlottesville, I'm Sandy Hausman.
Meanwhile, federal judges have refused to set bond for two California men charged with inciting a riot and attacking counter-protesters at last year's white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. The Daily Progress reports that Michael Maselis and Benjamin Daly remain held without bond following separate court hearings on Monday. Authorities say Maselis and Daly were members of the Rise Above movement, a white supremacist group. Maselis, Daly, and two other men were arrested in October on charges stemming from violence that erupted at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in August 2017. Prosecutors say Maselis and Daly both traveled to Europe after the rally to meet with neo-Nazi and fascist groups and attended a festival in Germany celebrating Adolf Hitler's birthday. Their trial is scheduled to start in January. Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring will bring his listening tour to Charlottesville on Wednesday. The Daily Progress reports the visit is the fourth in a series of discussions Herring is holding across the state as he pushes for legislation in next year's General Assembly against hate crimes and white supremacist violence. In Virginia, hate crimes rose from 137 in 2016 to 202 in 2017. That's a 64% increase from 2013, when there were 123 hate crimes reported. Nationally, FBI numbers show an increase in hate crimes of more than 17% in 2017 from 2016. Wednesday's discussion will take place at First Baptist Church in Charlottesville. The House Ethics Committee is reviewing an allegation that 5th District Virginia Republican Congressman Tom Garrett used congressional staff to perform personal errands. The committee's chairman and ranking Democratic lawmakers say that the committee received a referral from the Independent Office of Congressional Ethics. That office had interviewed several of the congressman's aides and concluded that, quote, Garrett and his wife requested extensive personal errands and unofficial work from congressional staff. The office investigates complaints from the public, but only the House Ethics Committee has the power to punish a lawmaker for wrongdoing. Garrett is a first-term lawmaker who did not seek re-election and is leaving office in January. He said he needed to work on recovering from alcoholism and renewing his commitment to his family. On Tuesday, former Ambassador John Negroponte visited the Miller Center to discuss America's role in the world, President Trump's take on foreign policy, and his own 40-year experience. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini reports.
John Negroponte has been the ambassador to Honduras, Mexico, the Philippines, the United Nations, and Iraq. He was also a deputy national security advisor to President Ronald Reagan and the first director of national intelligence under President George W. Bush. But he also worked under George H.W. Bush.
For George Bush, I think a lot of foreign policy and a lot of his life was about relationships. He cultivated them, he nurtured them, and I'm not saying in some kind of superficial or, you know, just a guy who cares about his Rolodex. No, somebody who really cared about other people, and he reflected that not only in his personal life, but in his conduct of relations with other countries.
Fast forward to today. Now, at the halfway point of the Trump administration, what does John Negroponte think about the state of American foreign policy?
It's a little bit like a fire or a flood going through your house, and it really boils down to the question of how much damage has really been done. Well, I don't think it's a total loss, and I think it can be fixed.
For WMRA News, I'm Marguerite Gallerini.
Several JMU students have been working to help the nonprofit Suitcase Clinic solve the big issue of providing better health care to those who are homeless in Harrisonburg. In her first report for WMRA, Bridget Manley reports.
The students in the Community Innovations class, all studying different majors and with the help of a group of professors through JMU X Labs, designed a shipping container that staff from the Suitcase Clinic can use to visit its homeless clients. Rhonda Zingraf is the director for the Institute for Innovation for Health and Human Services, the home of the Suitcase Clinic. She said she was impressed with how the students were able to tackle something as complex as healthcare for the homeless.
To see the students reaching that same level of strategic planning that would go on in leadership meetings here at the university over what we would need to do to make a decision lets me know that our students are doing a great job.
Since 2011, the clinic has been serving people who use the shelters in Harrisonburg, but with a shipping container, the clinic would be able to serve clients in the streets, in addition to treating those who visit shelters. Lindsay McLucas says that the course has taught her that homelessness is a multifaceted problem.
I think my biggest lesson was that I got to learn how many things go into homelessness and that it's not just one thing that goes wrong, but it's the culmination of so many different things that can also happen to anyone.
The directors of the Suitcase Clinic will take the students' work back to their board to see if they can implement the recommendations, which include the purchase of an inexpensive shipping container to remodel and partnering with local trucking companies to move the container whenever necessary. For WMRA News, I'm Bridget Manley.
Finally today, the day after Thanksgiving, the federal government published its fourth National Climate Assessment, a report full of alarming conclusions about how climate change could affect life in the United States. At one local ski resort, thinking about a warmer and less snowy future has already begun, WMRA's Andrew Jenner reports.
Jet engine? Torrential downpour? Try a Ratnik snow gun, turning 40 gallons of water every minute into fine white snow drifting down onto a ski trail at Massanutten Resort.
Oh, without machine-made snow here in Virginia, we probably wouldn't have a ski area. I think that, you know, we would probably be limited to a day or two a season without machine-made snow.
To make snow, the wet vault temperature, a measurement that factors in humidity, has to be no more than 28 degrees. On this late November morning, it's a good bit colder than that as Kenny Hess, Massanutten's Director of Sports and Risk Management, checks in with his crew working to take full advantage of a cold snap.
Hey Eddie, can you repeat that and give me the temps?
22 wet bulb at the top, 21 at the base.
This is our 48th season, I believe, and we average opening around December 10th or 12th.
Thanks to enough cold weather and the resort's more than 200 snow guns, Massanutten's ski season is set to open this Saturday, right on target. But being weather dependent means the fortunes of a ski resort in Virginia can vary significantly from one season to the next.
I've seen years where, you know, we were only open for 35 days, and there's been years that we were open for 120 days. It's Mother Nature, it's fickle, and we're snow farmers. You know, sometimes we have a good snow crop and sometimes we don't.
Because of their reliance on machine-made snow, it's temperature rather than snowfall that matters most at Massanutten and the region's other ski resorts. Either way, there's a major lurking challenge out there for Virginia snow farmers such as Hess: climate change.
Yeah, we talk about, you know, what will that mean for us in 20 or 30 years, 10 years, 50 years, whatever it is.
Analyzing data from a weather station in nearby Luray, the University of Virginia Climatology Office found a statistically significant decrease in the number of cold winter nights between 1976 and 2011. Jerry Stenger, director of the Climatology Office, says the data show a trend of 7.5 fewer days per decade with low temperatures of 20 degrees or colder over that period. That's oddly specific language because records from the Luray station are a bit spotty, and because it's only describing one specific statistical analysis. Still, in layman's terms, it looks like really cold winter nights in the valley aren't as common as they once were.
You know, I think in general, when you look at a sport like skiing, which is weather dependent, regardless of your outlook on climate change, it's important to take some of the uncertainty out of your business.
Adrian Saya Isaac is Director of Marketing and Communications for the National Ski Areas Association. The group adopted an official climate change policy in 2002 and has been outspoken about the issue ever since.
To that end, NSAA has taken a really focused effort on here's what we think climate change is going to bring to the industry and here are ways and resources for us to help you weatherproof your business. And in the bigger picture, hopefully stem some of the changes that we're seeing now.
Geraldine Link is Director of Public Policy for the organization.
Some of the messages that we've given to our resorts is to focus on mitigation or reduction of your own footprint, because that's a really important thing that we can do as a business. And then on another front, we stress adaptation with our ski area members. And that means changes in your operations or your planning to account for the impacts that climate change will have on your business.
At Massanutten, adaptation has already taken at least two forms. First, says Hess, there's ever-improving snowmaking technology that allows it and other resorts to take better advantage of any cold weather that comes along.
With the advances in snowmaking and the capital improvements, just because it's 45 degrees in Harrisonburg, Charlottesville, or Newport News, it doesn't mean we don't have a good product.
And then there's looking beyond skiing altogether.
We've put a lot more investment into our summer activities with the water park, with the downhill mountain bike park.
Those investments certainly weren't made only because climate change may jeopardize skiing revenues. Still, they reduce the resort's reliance on skiing if climate change were to make it a less reliable proposition in the future.
Massanutten will still be here and still be a viable resort whether we have skiing or not in 30 years or 40 years, just because we don't rely on the ski ticket sales to drive the engine of Massanutten.
That time still hasn't come, and the snow guns have been operating at full bore in recent days. Another ski season is about to begin, and Massanutten snow farmers are putting in their crop, hoping for the best while already planning for the worst.
There's no magic number, you know. It's like, oh, if we can't operate 50 days a year, 60 days a year, 70 days a year, at what point do we say, you know, this just isn't a viable enterprise anymore, and let's, you know, put our eggs in another basket and go another direction. We haven't got to that point yet, and I hope we don't have to, but, you know, it's something that's, you know, it's out there.
For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
You can learn more about that story at WMRA.org. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your Wednesday.